Welcome to our second live Q&A session of the day. Dr. Wolfram Laub from Johns Hopkins University will moderate the questions that came in for the physics, oligometastatic, MRI-guided radiation therapy, and lung sessions.
I'm assuming so. So welcome to this Q&A session, the last session of the day. Welcome everyone. I think we should probably start with some questions for Dr. Lee, since we just finished our presentation. If you have not submitted your questions, please go ahead and do so at this time. If you see questions you would like to have answered, I suggest you click on the arrow on the left side and upload the question, as we will go down the list in the order in which the questions are ranked. The first question for Dr. Lee is, how do you schedule SABR every other day or consecutive days?
So I think there isn't a strong evidence that every other day or once a day is detrimental or better with one regimen or another. Before I came to Houston, I actually routinely scheduled no more than 3 fractions a week, so sort of every other day, but the majority of my patients were treated with a 3 fraction regimen. Here, typically, our schedules are mostly 4 fractions, and so schedules are done every day. And I haven't seen a difference in efficacy or toxicity in my limited experience comparing the two regimens. So I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer for the fractionation schedule, whether you skip a day or you do sequential treatment. I don't think the data is convincing that one is better than the other.
All right, and the next question for you would be, what is the maximum size of a lung tumor you would treat with SBRT?
So typically, I think the standard answer is 5 centimeters or less. There's a few publications looking at larger tumors where the outcomes, not surprisingly, are a little worse as far as local control rates, probably in the 80% range. At the end of the day, it's looking at the indication for SBRT, trying to see that there is a benefit for giving shorter fractionation to get achieve better local control. So I think if a tumor is just beyond 5 centimeters, I don't think it's unreasonable to treat with SBRT or hypofractionated regimen.
All right, I'll do a few more questions for you. Within what timeline do you give PCI for limited SCLC? Is there a limit?
So the data suggests that the longer you wait, the worse the outcome based on historical studies. Typically, I would stage them with MRI brain and CT or PET-CT of the body. Assuming that it had a good response, usually a PCI I recommend between 3 and 4 months after a chemo radiotherapy completes. I wouldn't necessarily recommend beyond 4 to 5, 6 months. It's unclear if the outcomes would be consistent with the reported improvement in survival if you wait too long.
All right, and one more question for you. How do you prevent GTV over-contouring in SBRT? So do you have any suggestions for how to find ideal windowing?
So I guess the question is, when you contour GTV, how do you ensure that it does not overlap with the critical structure? So obtaining, of course, a 4D CT and looking at the, not just the mid, but actually the motion is important to make sure that your ITV is appropriate. That being said, there's a chance that the ITV does overlap with critical structures. And if your doses are exceeded in OARs for centrally located, ultra-centrally located tumor, my preference is to underdose ITV, knowing that at the time of treatment, even with the best IGRT, there's a chance that you might overdose the critical structure. So I typically would make sure the GTV is covered by the highest dose that I'm comfortable with and then underdose the PT.
I think the question is more, at least that's my understanding, of how you do the window leveling on your CT scan.
So for lung tumors, I like to start with looking at the lung windows. And then if it's abutting a soft tissue structure like mediastinum vessels, I like to give contrast first of all, and then switch to the mediastinal soft tissue windows, and then adjust the contours appropriately based on those two image sets.
All right, so we'll switch to a question for physics, and this may be a question Dr. Hall and Dr. Lee can also help answer. The question is, how can one do adaptive replanning on MRI? So I think the question is more about the process of doing adaptive planning with an MRI lean accelerator or based on repeated MRI scans during the course of treatment for patients.
Great. Thank you. Let me take first stab on this. Adaptation can mean 2 things. Can mean a geometric changes. We'll talk a little bit more about this, or could be decision-making changes. So primarily the question probably is related to geometric changes. There are two types of these geometric changes that could be observed, whether it's changing in the deformation of the tumor itself, maybe shrinking, or changes in the organ around it, especially in where, in cases where MR can make a difference, like NGI type cancers. So there is a replanning process that can take a place associated with that. The other aspect is dealing with the motion and motion changes. And in this case, the way I look at it is changing margins, whether making these margins tighter or larger, depending on the observed motion changes. Right. One other aspects for this kind of adaptation is also dealing with the decision-making process. And this would require understanding of the biology and making changes in prescription, but we are far from that. The other aspects that all these replanning procedures that we are talking about currently happen offline. So the beam is off in that case. So once we reach a stage where things can happen in real time, that's a different era that we are still not there yet.
Dr. Hall, do you have some insights on the process of doing adaptive planning with an MRI and accelerator?
Sure. So, you have to be a little bit careful with how you adapt and exactly what is causing you to adapt, particularly when you use an MRI. I think there are somewhat significant variations that we can see in MRIs, especially because of things like distortions or other artifacts that can occur in MR imaging. So we don't do a lot of really routine tumor-based adaptations from the initial CT and MR simulations that we acquire, unless we see really dramatic changes in tumor size during the course of treatment. What we do quite a bit of adapting for is variation in normal organ position, which I think is something that we commonly see, and we can account for that pretty safely and accurately using MRs that are acquired on the day of treatment. So I think adapting the tumor and clinical target volumes is not something that we at least commonly do, unless there's just dramatic changes in the size of the tumor, which can occur. But in the disease sites that we're most commonly treating with MR guidance, we don't see that a lot. And normal organ variation is something that can definitely be accomplished with adaption using MR. I mean, the other thing you have to be careful about is the process of adapting with MR takes approximately 20 to 30 minutes. At least in our experience, it's a time-consuming process. So if you're accounting for movement in normal organs and it takes you 15 to 20 minutes to do that, it's helpful to acquire another MRI right before you deliver your treatment, because sometimes what you just adapted for and accounted for can actually be changed back to the way it was initially. So you just have to be aware of those changes that can occur. Even intra-adaption, you can have normal organs moving that you thought you were accounting for. So it's a complex process that I think we're gonna have to work quite a bit on in the coming years.
I think this kind of leads to the next question for you. I guess the short version of the question is, can we afford to do adaptive radiation therapy with MI-guided lean accelerators? So the long version of the question is, MI-guided radiation therapy is intriguing, and I think it is the wave of the future. However, if you're replanning on a daily basis, how are you accounting for this in terms of radiation oncologist, dosimetrist, and physics staffing? Also, is the radiation oncologist and or physicist at the machine every day during treatment? How confident are you in the therapist's ability in terms of MI anatomy, and what training the therapists get in terms of MI anatomy?
Yeah, that is such a good question, and one that our specialty needs to take head on in the next 5 years, because this is a tremendously time-consuming process, and it does require, at least at our center, and I think most of the centers that are doing this, it does require a lot of time of radiation oncologists and physicists to be at the machine adapting for and changing our treatments and our treatment volumes and generating new treatment plans on a daily basis. So there's two thoughts I have on this. One is current day. How do we actually do this? And is it feasible? And then the second is future potential directions and applications. So current day, we do this. We're at the machine for a very long period of time. We do this in teams. So oftentimes I work very closely with colleagues who treat similar disease sites. We review the cases together. And then we schedule oftentimes, if it's our patient, we'll try to do the majority of the adaptions, and we block a period of our schedule that allows us to do that, similar to how you'd block your schedule for a brachytherapy procedure or some other time-consuming procedure that you might be doing. That's what we're doing currently. That creates scheduling challenges. And the best way that we've handled that is really having a team approach. So we'll do a case typically with a colleague and make sure the colleague feels comfortable adapting the treatment. And days that we're not available or we're not in clinic or we're, you know, at a meeting or on vacation or something, our colleague will cover that. This is an area that I think we have to prove our value though. And that's why part of my talk, I emphasize the current levels of evidence that we have. We need to generate high level one evidence that will support this effort such that we can really justify the time that's needed to do this. Because going forward in the current healthcare climate, it's not going to be sufficient enough just to say, we think this is beneficial. We want to spend an hour at the machine doing this procedure. We really have to generate high level evidence that proves this value. And I think there is definitely a potential for this to be significantly advantageous, and particularly for tumor sites that require ablative radiation, that are in close proximity to rapidly moving structures, particularly GI structures. I really think this can be quite advantageous, but we're gonna have to prove that. And that's gonna have to be done in prospective randomized trials. You know, I think this is an area where AI can really help us. And I do think that going forward, neural network-based contouring strategies will be a future of this. And whenever I talk to physics groups or groups that are interested in AI, I put this front and center because there's nothing more that I would like than a super robust neural network AI-based solution to come up with beautiful recontoured MR structures every day. And that would save us a lot of this time. That's perhaps a future direction, but tangible, I think, in the next 5 years.
So
let me interject here.
Yes,
and second what Dr. Hall has mentioned about the role of machine learning, particularly for MR adaptive radiotherapy. I think this is an ideal situation for application of machine learning and artificial intelligence techniques, given the high soft tissue discrimination of MR compared to combi CT, where AI is actually taking some place in that area. So this is an area that calls for direct automation, and that would reduce the time requirement significantly from 20 or 30 minutes to few minutes on.
So let me ask you, with the current technology, is it too early to go with an MR in the neck? Is it too time consuming with the current status of AI?
Okay, with the current status for AI, for computer vision applications like image segmentation and image registration, I think AI has proven a very high ability. You can reach segmentation results currently on especially on normal tissue, up in the 90% overlap index. Cancer or tumors still a little bit struggles, and I don't think AI alone without a human intervention still can get you the results you need for that. But in terms of normal tissue and deformation and image registration, I think the technology is up there.
Right. Let me ask a question for Dr. Kavanagh on oligometastatic disease, to switch topic a little bit. For patients on immunotherapy or patients who will start immunotherapy soon with oligometastatic disease, how do you approach those and fractionation and timing for external radiation therapy with immunotherapy?
It's a really good question. A similar question came up through the MedNet about a year ago, several months ago, and I don't think my answer is terribly different than it was then. And I do thank Percy for contributing some of the information. First of all, Percy did a great job and covered a lot of his ongoing effort, which is informing some of the tolerance of synchronous usage or sequential usage of SBRT and immunotherapy. There are some other sources of information. There was the University of Chicago trial of Pembro and SBRT that was published in JCO in 2018. It had about 50 lung lesions treated with SBRT and Pembro, and you can see in their reporting that there was not an unusual amount of interactions, let's just say. There wasn't a suggestion of synergistic toxicity or anything like that. So that's, I would say, some comfort in the combination of those types of agents. If the F was a question more, I'm reading the question right now. Actually, it must have just been removed because did you remove it when from the list when you?
Yeah, let me uncheck it. Here you go.
That's okay. Yeah. So I guess the dose fractionation question. Yeah. So, I mean, in those studies, thank you. I just wanted to make sure I covered the whole question. in those studies, I don't think there were a lot of dose fractionation questions asked per se. The different studies all had their own ranges of doses. So I guess I would say that we have participated a little bit in one of Percy's studies. So we've gone with the doses he already discussed there. I don't know that there's a standard otherwise to say much about. The other source of information that speaks to this topic is from Jim Welsh's group at MD Anderson, who've done a number of studies in which SBOT has been combined with one or another immunotherapy agent. And, you know, there was a low but not surprising, there was an incidence of pulmonary toxicity in the patients who got lung SBRT with immunotherapy, but not dramatically high. I'm looking at the one that came out in 2018. The first author was Verma, V-E-R-M-A, and they had 4 out of 60 patients with a grade 3 pulmonary toxicity, which is not zero, but not so unusually high. So, you know, some additional evidence that you can combine agents.
All right, and then let's go to the next question. Could you please give us good resources for doses to organs at risk sites for SBRT in abdominal pelvic areas, especially in re-irradiation areas? Also, do you have dose constraints for urethra and large bowel that are typically not reported?
Sure. Another good question. So I hope many people might be familiar with the Quantec papers that came out. That was a large-scale project spearheaded by the AAPM and a number of folks from ASTRO. There was a follow-up series of papers that was developed, once again, through AAPM leadership, Jim Grimm, and many other folks contributed to this effort. There will be a TCP and an NTCP paper coming out for just about every part of the body. I'm trying to remember the sequence. And whether the abdomen ones have come out yet or not. There was going to be one for an abdomen that I believe the first author was going to be Moyad Miftin, M-I-F-T-E-N. I think I saw a draft of that. So I think that might be in press. So there might be some more papers forthcoming from that. But in the meantime, if you wanted some handy references for abdomen, in addition to, you know, some of the published protocols that you can sometimes extract from, there was a paper from Dan Chang in, I think, Seminars of Radiology a couple years ago that had a nice little summary table. There was also, there's this paper, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the chapter and verse of the journal it was published in. I feel like it was in the Green Journal. Bob Timmerman wrote it, and it had a lot of constraints in there. I'll try to remember that and submit the reference to some accessible place for after the meeting.
And then let's go to the third question for you. Do you ever get pushback from the insurance to treat oligometastatic sites such as spine with SBRT? If so, how do you overcome it?
That's a great question. So short answer, yes. And to pick out spine in particular, I think everybody knows that the RTUG-0631 data that was presented by Sam Ryu at ASTRO last year was a disappointment to those folks who were cheering for SBRT to have made a better difference in the outcome, the primary outcome metric in that study, which was pain control at 1 or 3 months, I believe. So that is disappointing when using it for that particular reason. So in other words, for spine SBRT in particular, if you're doing it for pain control, there's really not a lot of evidence that you're going to do much better pain control wise than a more conventional or even hypofractionated simple setup. Having said that, for the purpose of treating an oligometastasis for extending disease-free survivorship in, let's just say, a lung cancer patient, I mean, I think there is some support from that in the literature, at least for lung cancer patients to date. And there's some limited support for that in some of the NCCN guidelines. We've had sometimes to go to peer review for cases like that. And I don't have a secret sauce for getting around that, but it is going to be challenged sometimes. I think what you need to be ready to do is argue that the patient has good performance status, long life expectancy, and you know, the control of this site will add a meaningful chance of disease-free benefit and or survival benefit. I don't have a mantra that always works though.
Okay, we'll go on and ask the next question for Dr. Lee. Do you ever give SABR for stage 1 non-small cell lung cancer in the absence of path confirmation in patients with poor KPS at high risk for pneumothorax with biopsy?
So I think this is not uncommon. I would say about 20 to 25% of the times we consider that. And my recommendation is that ideally this is done in a multidisciplinary fashion, that these cases are discussed at a tumor board where the surgeons and medical oncologists, radiologists are together. And ideally there are serial imaging showing that there's growth of the mass, there's increase in density, that the features of radiographic is consistent with cancer. And then it's important to document that the patient is treated empirically. And so with all that in mind, yes, I mean, in some situations when patients refuse a biopsy, they're older, they have had a bad experience with a biopsy leading to complications, we have offered patients with empirical treatment, particularly if they had prior lung cancer that was resected or ablated with treatment and biopsy proven. I think in those situations, repeat biopsy is perhaps less important.
All right, and the next question is, what PTB margin do you use for SBRT?
I mean, I think the standard answer is that with good 4D CT IPV approach, it's usually isotropic 5 millimeter margin. Bear in mind that there are a series of papers showing that recurrence are more likely to happen in the cranial caudal direction. So if you are uncertain about margins, I would err on the side of increasing that margin a little bit beyond that versus the other dimension. So between 5 and 6 millimeter in those situations.
Right. And then can you comment on serial MRI imaging as a means of avoiding PCI? Do you discuss this with or offer this to your patients?
So currently that's not standard of care. There is a study, 1827, otherwise known as MAVERICK, that's launched to look at a randomized fashion for limited stage and extensive stage small cell lung cancer with PCI versus a serial MRI. So I would think that it'd be best to put patients on that study rather than do this off study to determine whether serial MRI could be replacing PCI for some of these patients.
Right. And then there's the next question would be for Dr. Hall. As departments consider moving into the area of MRI simulators, how would you weight the advantages and disadvantages of a 1.5 Tesla MRI over a 3 Tesla MRI? And how would you decide?
Yeah, so I actually don't think when you get to 1.5 versus 3, I don't think there's that big of an advantage or disadvantage to one or the other. We use both. We have a 1.5 Tesla MR Linac, and then we have a 3 Tesla MR that we use quite frequently. I think that the 3 Tesla MR does, give you some clearer images, and I think the signal is a little bit better. And if you're going to do some, advanced spectroscopic type imaging or other advanced imaging, it's certainly the 3 Tesla is helpful. But I think honestly, a 1.5 Tesla has been fine. And the nice thing as well is that there's a lot of diagnostic literature that's been done with 1.5 Tesla. So if you're interested in incorporating, diagnostic MR research into your treatment planning, it's very easily done with a 1.5 Tesla, and the radiologists are also familiar with it. So I actually don't think there's a huge difference.
Any comments from Dr. Al Nakwa on this question?
Thank you. I agree. If your interest is in anatomical changes and diagnostic T1, T2, and their derivatives, that's the right answer. But if you are interested more in functional imaging information, you want to do high quality diffusion weighted MRI or DC MRI or other pulse sequences like spectroscopy, MRS, then there is the 3 Tesla would become more required in situation like that, having higher signal to noise ratio. However, there is also a price. Going higher in these Tesla would increase the distortion in the images. So you have to get a balance between the two. What's the requirements for that MRI system?
So on the same topic for you, how would you decide between a 0.5 or 0.35 Tesla or 1.5 Tesla MRI Linac?
For the MRI Linac, there are multiple aspects of this. A 0.5 Tesla can serve fine in terms of anatomical changes, and this has been demonstrated by the commercial systems that are available. It has less gradient distortion. It has also less electromagnetic interference if you are looking for online type imaging. Now, the 1.5 Tesla can provide you better soft tissue discrimination, higher signal to noise ratio, and presumably you can use it also for doing some basic functional imaging using DWI, for instance. So it becomes also, there is also financial aspects, whether which machine is more suitable for that clinic. And this is, I would defer to my colleague, the radiation oncologist, on that.
All right, Dr. Hall, next question for you. Quick and dirty tips for checking diagnostic MRI registration with CT SIM, since this is something that is not emphasized during residency and it could cause CT contouring to be off if not recognized quickly.
Yeah, great point. So there are two things you have to be really careful about. One is moving organs with respiration. So for example, the liver is one that immediately comes to mind. A lot of times your dosimetrists and people that are helping you will register to bony anatomy. They'll look for the spinal cord or vertebral bodies or ribs, and they'll register to that, but then the liver will be way off. So you just have to apply, I think, basic sort of common sense to what you're doing and look very carefully at what specifically you're using the MRI for. So if you're using the MRI to delineate a tumor in the liver, for example, it doesn't make any sense to register to the spinal cord. And you should be registering very, very closely to the organ that you are using the MRI specifically for. I mean, typically when you're delineating a volume, you're using that MRI for a very specific reason, and you're still defaulting to the CT SIM to do normal organs and that sort of thing. So I usually, whenever I talk to my residents about this, I say focus primarily on what you're using the MRI for, and then closely collaborate with diagnostic radiology. I mean, like I mentioned in my talk, we have a diagnostic radiologist who's jointly appointed in our department, and I review many, many scans with him. And if I'm wondering about a registration or how I'm bringing in MR information, I a lot of times will bring either my laptop down to the reading room or he'll come to my office and we review it together briefly. And he's been really, really, really helpful.
All right, and then the next question for you is if there's a role for MI-guided external beam radiation therapy in cervix cancer when brachy is not an option.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I that's been recently published on quite a bit by Kevin Albuquerque, and I think that it's tough. I don't treat a lot of cervical cancer, and I'd probably have to defer to some of my GYN expert colleagues, but I think, brachy is obviously the best option there, and that we've seen that recently with some of Dr. Albuquerque's work. And I think that, maybe in select circumstances, MR could play an important role. I don't know how helpful, adaptive MR image guidance would be in that setting. It's something that I think perhaps could be explored more, but until we have, I think, perhaps more compelling data, brachy remains extremely important.
All right. And then can you comment on sarcomas and MRI-guided radiation therapy? Could that change your volumes or margins?
Yeah, I think so. I think MRI is a phenomenal, at the very least, MR-SIM is phenomenally useful for sarcoma. We've seen that in a lot of Dion Wang's work and many other publications recently, that MR is very, very, very helpful. With regard to MR guidance in sarcoma, I don't necessarily know if it's super helpful, aside from a big interest of mine in our group here is, functional quantitative imaging that's acquired during treatment. So we have a large trial that we're getting diffusion weighted imaging every day, fully quantitative IVIM imaging before treatment, and oftentimes during treatment. And I think for sarcoma, that's tremendously interesting. And is a very, very appealing research question. But in terms of adaptive MR guided radiation, I think it potentially could be helpful, but definitely MR-SIM has been shown to be extremely helpful.
All right, Dr. Lee, I see a lot of clinical questions for you. Do you have can you see your own questions?
Yeah, I can pull them up.
Okay, do you want to? So the next question I see is there data to consider hyperfractionated radiation therapy for stage 3A disease? If so, what fractionation?
So right now we don't have a high level evidence for a hypofractionated RT for stage 3 disease. We did run a trial for my presentation looking at this in a dose escalating manner. There is also presenting my talk, NRG has a study LU04 looking at a regimen that's 60 gray in 15 fractions, but that's with concurrent immunotherapy, not with chemotherapy. That is the direction I think our field's going, however. I think looking at ways to shorten fractionation for things that take up to 6 weeks. But right now, I think, unless it's done sort of in a palliative manner or I wouldn't recommend it necessarily off trial for a definitive curable patient.
Great. The next question is, do you have tips or best ways to identify the hilum on CT for target delineation?
Well, I think number one is to use IV contrast. That's the most useful thing. And usually the hilum is highlighted by the convergence of the airways and the pulmonary vessels. And then, you know, when in doubt, talk to your radiologist. As Bill had said, I think they're very helpful when you're trying to determine sort of if you're covering the hilum sufficiently or not.
Can you comment on how to choose 34 times one or 18 times three for peripheral tumor SBRT?
So the RTOG study 0915 was 34 and one compared to actually 48 and four fractions showing comparable outcome. It hasn't been widely adopted. I think that in situations where, I suppose, if you have a peripheral lesion on your chest wall and the patient has issues with travel, that 34 in one may be, a single fraction may be considered. But bear in mind, you know, our standard peripheral dose, typically you want to get BED of greater than 130, 140 at this point, and potentially, 54 and three has a better biological effective dose. Again, going back to OTOG 0915, I don't know if you can fairly say they're comparable outcomes, because numerically, it seems like bulk control was a little bit worse and it was a smaller sample size. So the other issues would be tumor volume. I think I would be more comfortable with single fraction if the volume of target is between 10 and 12 cc's, but anything bigger than that, I would consider three or four or five fraction regimen.
When do you consider thoracic consolidation in extensive stage CLC?
I think Brian covered that a little bit. I think in patients with residual chest disease and with predominance of chest disease at presentation with a good response extra thoracically, those patients, I would highly consider thoracic radiotherapy. In a Slotman study, those patients got 30 in 10 fractions. We have typically gone a little higher, between 45 and 15, or 52, 50, and 15 fractions when we do consolidation therapy. And patients that maybe have upfront brain metastases are probably less likely going to benefit from thoracic consolidation. So I think it's picking those patients that are doing well, have good performance status, have mainly thoracic residual disease, and a great response extrathoracically. Those patients are ideal for consolidation.
All right. Back to oligometastatic disease. The next question here is, in the case of genuine de novo synchronous oligomets, do you prefer to start a local therapy to all sites or give systemic therapy up front to select outpatients destined to progress? How do you decide?
That's a good question. So we're always going to discuss those patients in a multi-D tumor board. I'm lucky to have really good colleagues in MedOnc, SurgeOnc, and radiology and all the rest of the specialties. And so we also have a bit of a skewed population. I'll say that just because some of our MedOncs have had a particular interest in developing some of the targeted therapies for tumors which are susceptible to TKI inhibition, the ones with EGFR and RET and ALK rearrangement, that sort of thing. So we have an unusually high percentage of those, probably relative to maybe the average distribution. So in those cases, where you have something that's going to be expected to be sensitive to one of the TKIs, those agents are so well tolerated. I mean, crizotinib, erlotinib, osimertinib, we pretty much always start with those. And it's really rare that a patient doesn't get the expected 8, 10, 12 plus months of disease-free survivorship out of them. And so we tend to treat those patients at the time when they, however, also like clockwork, will eventually show some oligoprogression. And that's typically at that roughly 1 year time point. And we tend to try to string along that subcategory of patients for as long as possible and using that kind of manipulation. for the patients who are not going to be fortunate enough to have one of those favorable mutations, we also do generally start with a doublet chemotherapy. Nowadays, of course, that's probably going to involve some immunotherapy, which is one of the complicating factors to know whether you can directly translate the data such as it is from Dan Gomez's study and others and Punithianga's study into this context. We more or less do that. I can tell you that we individually make the judgment that for people who are in a category of patients who would have fit the Alagomez study rubric, we probably will consolidate those patients. And but we do generally start with the systemic first. Percy, I'd be curious to know what you guys are doing, if you don't mind. Just to see.
Sure. I think off standard care, that's kind of the practice patterns. There are a couple study. I think one is called NorthStar for patients with EGFR mutation. So that study, we are giving patients with osimertinib for up to 12 weeks, and then doing early consolidation, not waiting them to progress. And the question there is obviously, is early consolidation going to be better than consolidation of time of progression? And in that study, interestingly, also there's an arm of patients with polymetastatic disease. So with consolidating those patients as well. There, I think it's sort of a dealer's choice which site to consolidate up to as many as you want, really. And it's more heterogeneous sets of patients. But that, and also a similar study using brigatinib, a single arm brigatinib to do consolidation at 8 weeks.
Yeah, if you really read the fine print of Dan Gomez's study protocol, there was a certain amount of clinical judgment allowed, let's just say. And you could make an independent determination that an individual site was either so well responded that you didn't need to treat it, or still a little bit left. And so there's still a little bit of art to the science there, I suppose. Yeah.
All right. I guess one more question for each speaker. For physics, any news on MRI-guided proton therapy?
Oh, great question. There are multiple technologies that are competing for identifying where the distal edge of the proton beam is going to be, which is something that would make proton therapy, as we deem it, more effective. This could be prompt gamma technologies using proton CT and using PET. Now, bringing MR into this fold comes with the challenges. You have a heavy charge. You have a heavy charge particles moving in an electromagnetic beam. That's what they create beam deflections. Some estimates, as I recall, for 200 MeV simulations in a one Tesla a magnetic field can yield a beam deflection up to 1 cm. This is quite large still, but potentially the future is there. There are people who are interested, and there are several studies looking into that.
Right, MRI-guided radiation therapy, last question. In high-grade glioma, how do you use T2 sequencing in contouring? How to avoid over-contouring? How about best sequences to identify optic structures such as the optic nerve and chiasm?
Yeah, so this is a really good question. There is some data looking at flare versus T2, particularly for high-grade glioma. And this is one where I think, you know, we tend to be a little bit more generous for glioma patients in general. You know, so collaborating with your diagnostic radiologist, hopefully these patients are being treated on a protocol. We are using multiple advanced MR sequences, particularly at the time of simulation, things that go beyond just, you know, T1 and T2 and flare-based imaging. I think that's very, very helpful. And obviously discussing the T2 signal changes with a diagnostic radiologist and accounting for the clinical circumstances, you know, is it a post-op scan? How much steroids has the patient been on? That sort of thing. All of that has to be taken on a case-by-case basis. And then to make it not too big, obviously cropping at natural boundaries to spread things that you know there won't be microscopic tumor cells likely extending beyond can be very helpful. And again, reviewing it with neuroradiology is super helpful. Was there another part to the question, or that was the other?
There was a question about about best sequences to identify optic structures.
Oh yeah, and usually we typically would use T2 weighted sequences at the time of MR sim, making sure that the head is in the exact same position, and ideally the patient has an MR sim in the immobilization device, and then using a T2 weighted sequence to identify the optic structures can be really helpful in those settings.
All right, lung. Do you use IMT or 3D routinely for stage 3 lung cancer?
So probably about 100% of our patients will try to get IMRT. I mean, there's no direct comparison between 3D IMRT, but from 0617, there was strong evidence that IMRT decreases heart dose, and heart dose is clearly an important factor in terms of morbidity and mortality in these stage 3 patients. So with that in mind, we generally treat everybody with IMRT.
All right, and then for oligometastatic disease, last question, do you have a dose constraint that you use for pancreas when doing abdominal SBRT?
Well, first question is, should you do pancreas SBRT? That would be probably a different question. There was an unfortunate, unspectacular result with the Alliance trial that was closed not so long ago that it didn't show to be as helpful as might have been hoped. I think there's some problems with that study. We'll look to see some more details coming out, I hope, as that study's looked at again, post hoc, so to speak. So I'm not sure I can tell you that that study would be a good place to look for constraints, because I'm not sure that the results of that were satisfying to the investigators. I would answer that in the same way I did before, that there are some upper abdominal constraint papers that are going to be coming out from High Tech, and the ones that I already mentioned that are in seminars, and the one from Bob Timmerman, which I will try to send the reference around, have some nice upper abdominal constraints.
All right. Thank you very much to everyone listening, and especially to our speakers for answering these questions. I think we're out of time, and I guess it's time for cocktails.
Thank you very much. Have a great evening, everyone. Take care.
Thank you.